So last time on Thursday, we were talking about a definition of architecture that's in comprehensive dictionaries that is usually not the first definition of architecture, but a legitimate definition of architecture as the underlying structure of anything. So that we talk about the architecture of a political campaign, or we talk about the architecture of a software program. And what we're referring to is this kind of conceptual, abstract, underlying basis of how that software program is put together, how that novel is assembled, or whatever. And, you know, on the tour last Saturday, I was emphasizing over and over this sort of, what is the underlying structure of the UT campus? How do we understand the entire campus in a kind of conceptual way? And there certainly is the hill, and then there are these malls, the East Mall, the West Mall, the South Mall, the little short North Mall. How does that inform? How did that inform over now more than 100 years how this campus has developed? And that underlying structure has been phenomenally important, both for giving an initial sense of the campus as this strong, powerful thing, but also to help all of the individual buildings collect into something bigger and more powerful than if they were all just a bunch of random buildings sitting around. That underlying structure of the campus is so important. And then likewise, we were looking at individual buildings and how they also have an underlying structure, and maybe what ties together buildings on the UK campus and gives them some cohesion is this base that's one kind of activity, maybe classrooms and more public functions, and then upper levels, and they might be treated in a different material, and those are more the faculty offices or the laboratories, and then maybe at the top underneath the roof, there are these brackets and kind of lightening up, and so that we get this vertical stacking of how the building assembles. And whether it's on a sloped side or whether it's on a flat side or whether it's 5 stories tall or whether it's 3 stories tall, there's this underlying structure that pulls things together. And even we could stand on one side of the West Mall and see Battle Hall from 1910 or see Flawn Academic Center from 1964, more than 50 years apart, and yet there's an underlying structure that's tying them together. So, very important notion, a very fundamental thing to understand about architecture. Good form, good design is generally based on some kind of underlying structure. So the Twitter card question last time was to ask you to think of some building in your experience that has this kind of underlying structure, and what is it? And actually, I was quite blown away. That's kind of a hard question. Just, okay, you heard that concept, now apply it. And often people struggle, and a lot of people in class did struggle with this one. But we got some really good answers. Let me give you some examples. So some people took it at the scale of the city as we were looking at Austin or Savannah. For instance, someone said, the layout of the city of Paris contributes to its air of importance and grandeur. With the Arc de Triomphe at its center and grand boulevards such as the Champs-Élysées radiating out as spokes, it seemingly dwarfs the surrounding city streets. Fantastic observation. Had these kind of muddle of medieval streets in the 17th, 18th century. They came with the Étoile, and they made this center, and then the radiating pieces. They put the Arc de Triomphe in the center of that. Very powerful structure. We identify that centrality, that focus, that radial pattern very much with Paris. Someone else says, again, looking at a city, New York City is the absolute best example for this place with an underlying structure. With organized streets that create one of the world's greatest experiences, walking around New York and observing how it's structured allows for a greater appreciation of the magnificent architecture the city has. Again, in that case, a relentless grid, but a very particular grid with blocks that are skinny in one direction and wide in the other direction. And as you go on those north-south streets, you get skinny, 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 skinny. As you go on the east-west street, broad. Makes the streets totally different in one direction than they are in the other direction. And it's powerful as a structure for that city. Someone else, again, looking at a city, said the underlying structure of Washington, D.C. points to the power of the central government. With the Capitol building in easy view wherever you are, as well as the different monuments placed around the city, it depicts the grandiose power and freedom our country has come to represent. Again, fantastic example. And in the case of Washington, there is this very strong grid with this very strong axis of the main mall organizing the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, the Capitol Building, all of those making a very strong central structure, and a grid that radiates out from that. But then there are these diagonal streets, just as in Paris, that connect, say, the Capitol Building to the White House. Is the technology finally working? Okay. So, that's what's coming ahead. And on this Thursday, I will give out to you, there will be an extra handout, And on that handout, it will have five essay questions, which will be the essay questions for test number one. There will only be two of them on the test, but you'll need to prepare those five essay questions and be ready to answer any of them on the test the following Thursday. Yes? Say again? The test will be a week from Thursday. I'm using the word quiz and test interchangeably. Sorry about that. There is one, I don't know, what's the difference? An exam, a quiz, a test? I don't know. Whatever we're having it a week from Thursday. Okay. So today we're talking about numbers, mathematics, and geometry as an inspiration for form. And I'm going to begin by telling you a little story. And this is a story about a guy named Fibonacci, F-I-B-O-N-A-C-C-I, Fibonacci. And he lived in the 13th century in Pisa in Italy. And the name Fibonacci actually means, in Italian, son of a simpleton. And that didn't mean that his father was stupid. But what it meant was this kid was such a genius that it made his father look stupid by comparison, because he was an incredible genius. So he was a mathematical genius in the 13th century in Pisa in Italy. And the thing that he's the best known for is he brought Arabic numbers to Europe. So in Arabia, they'd been using our number system like we use now for centuries, but in Europe, they were still using Roman numerals in the 13th century. So you can imagine how difficult it would be to add a bunch of numbers when you're using XVIII plus XIII plus IV. Oh my God, impossible. So when they actually started to do mathematical manipulation, Roman numerals were super cumbersome. And Fibonacci was the man who figured out we can't keep using these Roman numerals. We need to use the Arabic numbers because they actually have more utility. They allow us to do things with numbers. Phenomenal change in mankind. I mean, this was huge. And Fibonacci's the man who introduced that in a book called Liber Abaci in the 13th century. This guy loved numbers, loved mathematics. But in addition to seeing numbers as having utility, he also saw numbers as having a certain mystery and a certain kind of power. And in this way, he was still a medievalist. We talked about earlier that in medieval times, there was a great respect for emotion and for mysticism. Whereas in the Renaissance, they tried to clarify everything. But he was very comfortable with this notion of some numbers having a kind of mystical or mysterious sensibility. And he came to be known for a series of numbers he generated that are called the Fibonacci series. And the way he generated those numbers was he imagined that there was a pair of rabbits. And you put this male and female rabbit in a closed environment, and the idea was how many little baby bunnies would be produced in a year? How many rabbits would you have in a year? And there's some ground rules here. This is like, you know, sixth grade math word problem. The ground rules are that each pair of bunnies will have one new pair of bunnies every month, but that a bunny pair can't have offspring until the second month of their life. They're too immature in the first month. So the word problem is how many bunnies will there be in the first month, second month, third month, and so on. So obviously in the first month there's one pair of rabbits. In the second month that pair has an offspring, so in the second month there are two pairs of rabbits. In the third month the first pair will have another offspring, but the second pair is still too young to have an offspring. So in the third month, there are going to be five pairs of rabbits. In the fourth month, you get the picture anyway. It generates a series of numbers, and it's one, two, three, five, and then there'll be eight pairs of rabbits, and then 13, and then 21, and then 34, and then 55, and then 89, and then 144, and finally in the 12th month, there'll be 233 pairs of rabbits. And that series of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 50, and so on, is the Fibonacci series. And you can actually extend that ad infinitum, and you might have noticed here that every subsequent number is the sum of the two previous numbers. So that's how you generate that series of numbers. And they look pretty random on a sheet of paper, but in fact, that's a regular sequence of numbers. And Fibonacci found that to be an amazing, amazing series of numbers. And here's some of the reason why he thought they were so incredible. For one thing, if you take any Fibonacci number and you divide it by the number larger than it, you will get 0.618034. And that actually, it's not until the 14th number or something you get that, but eventually it's 0.618034. And the ratio of 0.618034 to 1 is what we call the golden proportion. And that's in your book. In Rasmussen, in his chapter on proportion, he talks about the golden section or the golden proportion. Sometimes that's referred to as phi, P-H-I. So all of these are things that have been around a long time, but to generate this series of numbers one way and then to, through multiplication or division, get this ratio that is constant all the way through, and that then actually is this relationship that for centuries had been important. So for example, the Greeks had used the ratio, the golden section, the golden proportion, or phi, and they had used it to proportion the Parthenon. The front of the Parthenon has that roughly 5-8 proportion. Those are two Fibonacci numbers. All the way through it, it's proportioned by that. But the Greeks came to it, as Rasmussen describes it, by using a ratio. A is to B as B is to A plus B, and that'll give you A and B or two subsequent numbers in the Fibonacci series. So the Greeks had been using that for a long time. And then way, way, way before the Greeks, the Egyptians had actually built the pyramids at Giza that were proportioned in very much the same way. So the height of the pyramids in Giza compared to the base is about 5-8, 5 and 8 being two sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. So they're about that proportion of 0.610034 to 1. So way, way back, 2500 BC, we have the Egyptians using this ratio. Then in Greek times, we have the Greeks again using this ratio, deriving it as a proportion. And then he generates this series of numbers by a completely different formula, that if you take one number, divide it by the larger, you get that same proportion. I'm beginning to think there's something really special in these numbers. Now, the Egyptians, it's even a little more spooky than that when you get to the pyramids. So in the pyramids, if you take the height of the largest pyramid at Giza, it's 5,813 inches high. And this was very precise. It had a knife edge. It's a little worn away now, but you can project up where the knife edge would have been, 5,813 inches. 5, 8, and 13 are three sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. So in addition to that, if you take that height and you make that the radius of a circle, and then you derive the circumference of a circle with that radius, you get a circumference that is 36,524.2 inches. And they worked in inches in Egypt. Did they know that the number of days in a year are precisely 365.242? Those same digits with a decimal in a different place. So we know that the Egyptians were fascinated with the cosmos, and they were fascinated with the tracking of seasons and the sun, but to embed in something the scale of the pyramid, those numbers and dimensions that would tie what they were doing to this most fundamental number or cycle of days in the year. And that's, you know, even to this day, our calendar doesn't track that exactly. That's why you have to have a leap year, because we don't have a calendar that exactly fits that number of days in the year. So that's all pretty astounding. But this golden section has also been used in many, many other ways by many, many other people. Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, these guys used it to proportion their paintings, this golden section, and sometimes their architecture. Other examples in music, Bach, Beethoven, Debussy, Bartok, all of them used sequences of Fibonacci numbers to give certain rhythms to their pieces. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, for example, is one that is very much tied to this golden section. Even Stradivarius, when he made these beautiful violins, the F curve that's in that violin where the sound comes out of the box, that F curve was proportioned by the golden section. And so all through history, there's been this fascination with it. Some of you may have read years ago the popular book called The Da Vinci Code. Anybody read that? That one is chock-a-block full of all of this lore that goes along with Phi or with the golden section. And it's pretty phenomenal through time. So in the 19th century, there began to be psychologists, physiological psychologists, just as that study was being born, who began to say, well, is this in our DNA? Are there certain proportions or certain mathematical relationships or certain ratios that are just embedded in us as preferential? So there's a guy named Gustav Fechner, a German psychologist. And this is right in the beginning of days where people were beginning to think that our psychology might be tied to actually the structure of our brain. Is there something in the structure of our brain that prefers some things? So he asked, he did a kind of study of rectangles, like doors and books and writing pads and windows, and studied all these rectangles all around him in Germany. And when he found the kind of most normative rectangle that was out there, it was a golden section, about 5 to 8 in proportion. He had an acolyte, a guy named Wilhelm Wundt, who then took that study a bit further and began to show people in studies. Here are a bunch of different rectangles of different proportions. Which do you prefer here? And 75% of the people preferred the golden rectangle to other ones. And these guys began to say, well, there's something physiological. There's something in the structure of our brain that prefers that. Now, it even gets a little spookier when you start, because you can take that just rectangular proportion and you can get curvilinear proportions out of that. So let me describe how that works. And you may follow me, you may not follow me, it's not a big deal if you get lost here. But on your notepad, I want you to make a golden rectangle. I want you to make a horizontal golden rectangle that is essentially 5 units high by 8 units wide. So just, you know, take the lines on your paper and maybe make it 5 units tall and figure out 8 units across, or make it 10 units tall so each of those is 2. But make yourself a golden rectangle that's horizontal about 5 by 8 units. Now, on the left-hand side of that golden rectangle, I want you to make a square. That is, you go over 5 units, and it's 5 units tall, go over 5 units, and make a line down there that will make a square on the left-hand side of that. Then, in fact, you'll be left with a vertical golden rectangle on the right-hand side. So that's this interaction between square and rectangle. So you get the golden section rectangle on the right-hand side. In the bottom of that, I want you to take a square out again. So take the width of it, measure up that distance high, and make a square right there. And what you'll have left over is a horizontal golden rectangle at the top there. Okay, on the right-hand side of that, pull out a square again like we did before. Now, I can tell by your face, 3/4 of you are lost already. But if you put a dot in the center of each of those squares, and then you pull out your French curve out of your pocket, which I'm sure everyone has with them, and then you connect those dots, what you'll get is something called a golden spiral. And that is a curvilinear form that is generated by this golden proportion. And that golden spiral is everywhere in nature. So a snail is in the shape of a golden spiral. Tiny planktons are often in a golden spiral. Claws and beaks on birds are the shape of a golden spiral. The inside of a wave, when you shoot the gap on a wave, the inside of that is a golden spiral. The inside of Cape Cod, as nature has worn away over the centuries, the inside of Cape Cod is a golden spiral. It's all over. But maybe the most phenomenal example of all the spookiness of these numbers is sunflower seeds. So sunflowers, you know, big yellow blooms, lots of yellow petals, and in the center there's a huge seed pod in the middle of a sunflower. And if you look very closely at the middle of that, it actually has two golden spirals, one clockwise and one counterclockwise, and they interlock with each other. And if you have the patience to take that seed pod and pull out all of the seeds in one golden spiral, and then pull out all the seeds in the other golden spiral, you'll be rewarded with two sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. So a normal sunflower will have 21 and 34 seeds. 21 in the smaller spiral, 34 in the larger spiral. A particularly large one will have 34 and 55 seeds. A really small one will have 21 and 13 seeds. So, unbelievable kind of connection of Fibonacci numbers, golden spirals, natural form. Kind of spooky. Now, all of this in a certain way is just interesting to me. I mean, I find that totally fascinating. And how all these numbers and geometries are interlocked together. But for someone like Fibonacci, and for many, many architects and other form makers through the centuries, this has been very generative. This notion that there's some kind of mysticism to certain numerical, mathematical, geometric relationships. And when you embed those in a building, it makes it a better building, a more important building. It adds something to the building. So I'm going to say that there are 5 different ways that through the years, numbers, mathematics, and geometry have given certain assets to a building. And I would say the first thing is that they have embedded a kind of mysticism into buildings. So sometimes these numbers are put into buildings for the magical qualities that people felt like derived from that. A second reason why they're injected into a building is to add prestige. And there is something in these mathematically based buildings that just seem more important or more prestigious. A third thing they do is then, again, oddly enough, when you use these kinds of geometries, often it gives you structural efficiency. Somehow the cosmos has decided that these geometric forms behave better in gravity and make a more efficient structure. So sometimes it just makes structural sense. A third thing is there is a way that our eye just focuses on geometry often, and it can give an iconic quality to a building. And the fifth thing is that often it's a way of kind of embedding an intellectual puzzle in a building. And it starts making our mind curious, and we start deconstructing and reconstructing something in the building. So we're going to look at buildings that do, that use numbers, mathematics, and geometry as an inspiration for their form and utilize it in each of these five different ways. And to begin with, let's just take a look at the freaking pyramids, which are so phenomenal. So I said before, you know, all these numbers that are in there. The tallest of the pyramids at Giza, 5,813 inches. You know, 5, 8, and 13 being three sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. Take that, make the circumference of a circle. It tells you how many days exactly there are in a year. In addition to that, of course, a pyramid is equilateral triangles on each of its faces. So it's got that perfect geometry of the equilateral triangle. The base is, of course, a square. So it's a square and an equilateral triangle. As I said, the height compared to the base is about that golden proportion, about 5 to 8. And when you think of all the effort they went into to build these pyramids, I mean, one of the things that is not so well known, but you know, they didn't have any building stone where the pyramids are in Giza. They actually had to get the building stone from several hundred miles upriver on the Nile. So they quarried the stone. They had to transport it quite a long way to the river. They then had to take it up barges up the river. They then had to take it off the barges, and they had to somehow carry these stones over to the actual site of the pyramids, and then they had to erect them. I mean, it's a crazy complicated process. And this is in 2500 BC. I mean, ancient technology we're dealing with there. But then it's done with such precision that it's not just the outside that has these numerical relationships, but all kinds of things about how the stones are put together on the inside also are embedded with certain proportions and numerical relationships. There you can see how on the face of these, originally, there was this very smooth skin of stone and very precise edges, and that's how we get the numerical dimensions that go with them. And there you can see that sense of, you know, assembling. This enormous effort to do what? To make a geometric object. There's essentially no habitable space inside the pyramids. They didn't have a function. They were there to bury a pharaoh and to transport the pharaoh to the afterlife. And it was a way of getting immortality. How do you get immortality? Through these numbers, mathematics, and geometry. There was a mysticism there, a faith that transported you to the afterlife. But an incredible amount of time and energy and work and resources to simply make these simple geometric objects. So that's certainly an example of this kind of mysticism. Another example, 4,000 years later in the Renaissance, we have Leonardo da Vinci. And Leonardo da Vinci, of course, in the Renaissance, they had this notion that human beings were the center of the universe. We were God's greatest creation. We had the ability to think. We were the perfection of nature. So if you wanted to really understand perfection, you would study us. And you would study the human body. And the human body could tell you about making the very ultimate kind of physical form. So Da Vinci is trying to understand the human body. And he makes this drawing on the right. Now, that drawing has become, it's everywhere. I mean, it's on coffee mugs, it's on T-shirts. It's a very popular drawing. And I think for most people who, you know, buy the coffee mugs or the T-shirt, it's just this really buff, naked dude. I mean, that's the whole message here. But in fact, I don't think that's what Leonardo was about. What he's doing is he's trying to understand the numbers, mathematics, and geometry of the human body. So this square that he's drawing around the outside there, he has the arms are outstretched, and he's noticing that in a perfectly proportioned human body, the height is equal to the arm span, and that makes a square, right? And then he also says that then if you splay your arms and legs like this, and you have the navel as the center, then that makes a perfect circle. So there's something in your body that makes a square and that makes a circle. That geometry is embedded in your body. In addition to that, he again looks at the proportions of your legs and your arms and your torso. And he observes that if you take the proportion from the ankle, from the floor to the knee, and compare that from the knee to right at your groin, those are equal dimensions. If you take either of those dimensions and compare it from the floor to the navel, that is a golden proportion. If you take the wrist to the elbow and compare it to the wrist to the shoulder, that's again a golden proportion. So that he says that embedded in our bodies, God's ultimate creation, are these special numbers, mathematics, and geometry. The square, the circle, the golden proportion. Then he says in good Renaissance logic, okay, if that's what God determined were the ideals, if we're going to build a church, if we're going to build a house for God, we need to embed those things in the architecture. So in his sketchbooks on the left, he starts imagining how could you use these forms to make a church. And he comes up with all of these centrally planned churches that are made up of assemblies of squares and circles. So we get the square here, a square inside the square, all these circles, semicircles. They then, in three dimensions, begin to produce domes or semi-domes or cubes. And that then, for him, is the way to generate the most appropriate architecture for the house of God. That then leads in the Age of Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th century to people who begin to say, well, let's really make the entire environment about these pure geometries. So on the right, we get a Frenchman named Etienne Boulay, who he's making a monument to Sir Isaac Newton. Sir Isaac Newton had discovered gravity, and he had begun to understand how the cosmos works and how the planets work in relation to each other. He's a great scientist. If you're going to make his tomb, you would want to make a perfect geometric form. So on the right, we get this sphere, massive sphere, set on this cylinder. Even the entry to it, this tiny little door, is a half circle. But all of these pure geometries are there to commemorate the greatness of Isaac Newton, never built, but a conceptual idea. On the left, his disciple, a guy named Claude Ledoux, begins to conceive of a house that is a sphere. This would be the perfect way to live, that you're inside this very perfect geometry. And in fact, Claude Ledoux got the commission to do a utopian city. This is a city that was meant to have the ideal environment, that people would get along with each other, there would be no political turmoil, there would be no crime, everyone would be enlightened and would be their best self. And if you're going to make a utopian city like that, you would want to use these kinds of perfect geometries. So in the slide on the right, you can see the form of show as we look down on the city. And it is a great circle, a series of circles actually. And then these axes that go through north, south, and east, west through the town of Sho. At the very center of the whole composition is the major industrial source of income for the economy, which is a salt works. This particular area had salt, and they were mining the salt and refining it. Salt, of course, is a chemical that we need in our body. We can't survive without salt. It also happens that salt is crystallographically a very interesting compound. It's NaCl, sodium chloride, but in its crystallographic sense, it is a series of cubes at the cellular and molecular level. It is always cubes, and it's very unique in a crystallographic sense. It also is what's called isometric, so that if light penetrates it at any angle, the light moves through at the same speed. Again, that's a very unusual property for a compound to have. So it's this perfect geometry of the cube that is the source of salt. Salt is this essential chemical for human life. That becomes the center of the community of Sho. And then around that circle, there's the salt works in the center. Around in the first ring is all of the public buildings of Sho, the schools, the governmental buildings, the art museums, the libraries. Those important buildings are in the first ring. Then the second ring is all of the pillars of the community, their homes, the kind of wealthy people were there. And then the following rings subsequently are all the way out to the peons. So there is this notion of the geometry organizes everyone and makes this utopian community. And pretty much all the buildings within it also have this pure geometry affecting them. On the right is the crematorium. That's where everybody's being, again, transported past death. On the left is a factory. You can see that big square divided into four squares, a little square building in the center at the intersection of those axes. The squares on the corner turned into pyramids. Those become the smokestacks. Everything employing geometric form. There was one building type within the community that actually he thought was so essential that he did two different versions of it, one on the left, one on the right. This is called the Maison de Plaisir, or the House of Pleasure. It was actually a brothel. Maybe a little like Leonardo da Vinci. He's looking at certain anatomical analysis. And so he observes certain circular balls and then an ellipse that might create a kind of head of the architectural composition. But it's, again, using geometry as a predominant source of creating the architectural form. Everything, housing, everything in the community is based on these geometries. On the right, we have the house for the keeper of the waterworks. Again, an essential part of the community, water. And it comes through this circular form through the house of the keeper of the waterworks. On the left, this is the cooper's house, the guy who makes wheels. Again, wheels, this incredible invention for humankind. How could we do without wheels? It's enabled mechanization completely. What is the wheel? It's a perfect circle. So the cooper's house, the guy who makes houses and makes wheels, his house is all about a circle. Again, this is a way that architecture has, through time, used these geometries as a kind of mystical association that would elevate the architecture. So that's one thing. We do it for this mystical connection to God, to nature, whatever. A second reason why we might use this geometry is in order to make more prestigious forms. Make forms that elevate that building, make it more important in the community. And the first example we're looking at here is a library, a central library in Stockholm in Sweden. And this was done by Gunnar Asplund. Gunnar Asplund is used as an example by Rasmussen in Experiencing Architecture. Clearly thinks Asplund's one of his favorite architects. I'd agree with that. Really great Swedish architect. And this was done in the 1920s. Now, what was happening here is there was no tradition of having public libraries in Sweden. This is one of the very first public libraries. Books were things people had in their home. Rich people had books, but the public didn't have access to books. And this was a new idea. People are beginning to be educated. They can read the books. More books are being printed. Swedish is a tiny language, so there aren't really that many books in Swedish. But the Swedes are very proud of their language and of their literary tradition. So this is a big deal. We're going to make this accessible to everyone. We're going to have a public library. But they didn't have any history of this. If you're going to make a church, there's a long tradition of making churches. But if you're going to have a public library, what should it look like? How do we give it the kind of prominence we want in the community? And what Aspelin does is he boils it down to two clear geometric forms. A base that is a square that turns into a kind of cubic form, and then a circle that then generates a cylinder in the center. And the experience of the building is based exactly on that. You come in the front door, and you have these reading rooms that go around like that, but then you go into the center, into this rotunda, and it's actually quite clever. You walk in the front door, then as you go up the stair, you emerge into the central book space in the center of the room. You walk up those stairs and you enter in the center of the circle. And it's kind of an astounding moment. It definitely adds prestige. It adds monumentality to the experience of that place. It seems elevated. And it's that pure geometry of the square and the circle and emerging in the center of the circle that does that. So in the slide on the right, we're walking up the stairs, the big chandelier that comes down there. As we get up there, we see the circle all the way around us. There are the reading rooms with the rectilinear geometry, the contrast between those two, certainly adding prestige to the library. Similar kind of thing is happening at the Guggenheim Museum in New York by Frank Lloyd Wright, 30 years later or so. And here again, this is Solomon Guggenheim has acquired this great collection of very modern art. At the time, people didn't get modern art much. They thought it was crazy and threatening. And Guggenheim was a huge advocate of abstraction and of modern art. So he wants to build this museum and make his collection available to everybody to see this this new thing, this modern art. But he's got to call attention to it. He's got to make it something that has a certain level of prestige. So here in the middle of New York, which is all about rectilinear geometry with all those that street grid, Frank Lloyd Wright uses these very strong geometric shapes, very abstract geometric shapes, to give this function of the modern art museum a level of prestige that will elevate it in the community in New York. So in fact, the whole building is made out of very pure geometric shapes. You can see the great circular shape of the main room in the center there. There's another circle on the side. There's a square that sits on top of that circle, and then another circle on top of that. You can see the whole underlying grid is all squares with circles inscribed in the squares at two different scales. Often they're segments of circles, half circles. Up on the top left of that big circular form, you can see the equilateral triangle that actually houses the stair that goes up there. But virtually every bit of the form of the Guggenheim Museum is controlled by some integrated geometric shape. And then, of course, when you go inside, you find that that circular form has now become a helix, and the ramp is taking you up to the top of the museum. The idea was actually that you'd ride the elevator up, and then you'd walk down this ramp. And as you walk down the ramp with a great central space, you're seeing the art on the wall. And everything is just very, very abstract, nothing but geometry. No beautiful materials, no fancy detail. Everything is just depending on the power of that geometry to give a level of prestige and importance to this notion of an art museum for contemporary art. And it worked. I mean, the thing is immediately very powerful institution in New York City, and to this day, super powerful institution in the city. So a second reason is to add prestige. A third reason is that, as I said, it turns out it makes structural sense. If you actually just want to make an efficient building, if you want to use the least amount of material to do the most amount of work, often geometry achieves that. An example here is the U.S. Pavilion at the Expo in Montreal in 1967. The, quote, architect on it was Buckminster Fuller. Buckminster Fuller, it's very hard to put a label on him, period. He was trained as an engineer. He was famous as a philosopher. He did a lot of architecture, the Dymaxion House, the Judaistic Dome, invented a number of strong architectural forms. And he was essentially the designer of the pavilion at the Montreal World's Fair. So this is, of course, space era. In the 1960s, we had taken on the goal of putting someone in space, and we'd begun to do that by 1967. And it seemed appropriate somehow that this form would have something to do with the shape of the Earth or the shape of the Moon or these planets that we were up to. But in fact, it was incredibly efficient structurally. What they needed was a big volume of space to put these very, very large exhibits in. The primary exhibit in 1967 was the space program. So they were showing capsules, and then showing the capsules with the parachutes in place. So they needed a big space to display this. And the Geodesic Dome is a super efficient structure. It is both structurally efficient in a macro sense because it creates a dome, and a dome is an efficient structure. But it is also structurally efficient because it doesn't use one material to make that dome. It uses tiny little bits that it assembles together in this tetrahedral grid that then makes up that larger dome. So at a micro sense, it's tetrahedral. At a macro sense, it's a dome. But the combination of those two things allows you to use the least amount of metal to make the longest span you possibly can. And this geodesic dome that Fuller invented was not only used in this kind of building, but it was used like Arctic explorers going to a long, long way away and with difficult transport. You would have very lightweight materials that then you could assemble to make a geodesic dome and get very basic shelter. It's super efficient that way. The lightest amount of material for the maximum amount of space created. So they build this geodesic dome. They also then put into it, in the tetrahedral planes, they put little shade structures, little shading devices, and they were put on photosensors. So if the sun was out, these little things would click in and you would have it shaded. And then when the sun went behind a cloud, those would click back and you'd get more light. So it was naturally lit by all of these shades that were in the tetrahedral structure. And on the right, you can see some of them open, some of them shut. It was pretty dramatic when you were in there. You know, maybe the sun's behind a cloud, and then it comes out, and then it goes click, 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 and all these shades automatically shade the building and create the right light quality inside. So the structure is working with the sun outside to create just the right amount of lighting inside the building. And then, as I said, you've got this display with the space capsule and the parachutes. And, of course, the parachute is a piece of geometry. It's a half of a dome. And that's because if you want to slow down something like a spaceship coming into Earth, that's the form the air makes to resist it with equal resistance all the way around. It makes that geometric form. So in this case, you're getting geometry out of just structural good sense, out of things that gravity, air resistance, structural resistance, all of those things generate these kinds of geometric forms. Okay, so we use it for mysticism. We use it for prestige. We use it because it makes structural sense. We also use numbers in mathematics and geometry because sometimes it helps create a kind of intellectual puzzle. And our brain likes to construct and deconstruct these kinds of puzzles. So this is the work of a guy named Peter Eisenman, an architect. He's actually still practicing architecture, kind of an old guy now. And you can see these very faint drawings that he would do on designing, in this case, just a simple house. So Peter Eisenman, and these drawings, this is before computer-aided drawings, so he's drawing these things with a rapidograph pen on vellum, and there are just thousands and thousands and thousands of lines, and he's doing this kind of crazy, compulsive puzzle that he's constructing. So if you can see barely on the top left, first he starts with a square that he extrudes up. And then he breaks the square into a 9-square grid. So the big square divides into 9 smaller squares. And then he observes that, well, that makes planes in one direction. And it also makes planes in the other direction. On the bottom left, you could put a column at the intersection of each of those grid points. On the middle one on the right, you could make that 1 unit, 2 units, 3 units out of that 9-square grid. What are the geometric possibilities that I can imagine just doing an analysis of this square? And then on the right, he starts to manipulate it more and more. At a certain point, he shifts the whole thing 3 feet so that then he gets a smaller dimension in there. And he sees what kind of puzzle he can work out of that. And then it's a combination of how much of these planes in one direction, how much of the planes in the other direction, what do I do with that 3-foot shift, it's really just a geometric puzzle that he's doing. And out of that comes this house. And you can see the plan of the house on the left. And it's a square, and then you can see that 3-foot shift to the left and up. And you can see that little zone that it creates. And then you can see the sort of 1 unit, 2 units, 3 units. Those are the inside. And then it creates an outdoor terrace that is 2 units and 1 unit. There are functions in this house, but that's kind of irrelevant. Like there's a bathroom there. These are kind of kitchen cabinets in that 3-foot shift there. This is a stairwell in that 3-foot shift there. But his philosophy was that function is irrelevant. I mean, human beings have lived in everything. They live in caves and they live in big old Baroque palaces. You can live in anything. So I'm not going to design you a house according to some kind of functional program. I'm going to make a beautiful geometric puzzle. It's going to be really intellectually intriguing. And it's going to be great to live inside this intellectual puzzle. So he did a whole series of these houses, and of course they were not named the Smith House or the Jones House, as is usually the case with homes that architects design, but these are numbered. So it's House 1, House 2, House 3, House 4, and he does a whole series of those in the 1960s. I think that's House 2 on the left, that's House 5 on the right. Some of them got built, some of them didn't get built. But people are living inside geometry, and there's this, you can kind of get this puzzle out of it. This one is House 6, one of the better known of this series. I think he got up to like 18 or something. But in House 6, you can see an axis, a plane in one direction. You can see a plane in another direction. You can see then these kind of cubes that are attached to the plane, and the cubes are then dissected into a series of planes that make the cubes, and what he makes solid or what he makes void or what he makes gray or what he makes white is all articulating these manipulations he's doing on the various geometries of the house. So it ends up. People live in these things. And there was a family who lives in house 6. And in the master bedroom, it happens because of some of the geometrical manipulations, there needed to be a slot that went right through the middle of the master bedroom. So that went through, it was a window on the outside, it was a skylight in the roof as it came down, it was a slot in the wall, and then of course it was a slot in the floor too, in the slide on the right. And of course you couldn't put a king-size bed or a queen-size bed in the room because there's a hole in the middle. So that means the couple's got to have twin beds in the master bedroom. Oh, damn. And then also, originally, it was completely open, but then one time one of them got up on the wrong side of the bed and ended up with their leg in the living room downstairs. So they put a piece of plexiglass in that. And they learned to accommodate how you could live in this geometric puzzle. On the left, you can see that, you know, you actually do have to get up to the second floor. But he didn't want to do a stair, not just like a handrail and a regular stair. That violates the whole idea. It's got to be geometrical. So he manages to make this black, abstract, geometrical object. But then you couldn't make it look like it was functional. That'd be stupid. So he actually flips it and turns it on upside down and makes it red. And so it's a manipulation where he rotates it and it becomes just an abstract form up above. So yeah, you can get up that stair, but far be it from him to say that's a stair. That's not a stair. It's a geometric object that can be flipped and turned and put in any direction. So it's interesting. And it's a way of looking at geometry and numbers and mathematics as something that's just intellectually puzzling or intriguing. And this is definitely an extreme of it, but you can see it in lesser ways in other buildings. So the final reason why we might use numbers, mathematics, and geometry is that it also is a way of focusing our eye. It's iconic. It gives identity to something. So in this case, this is a school of design in Germany, in Essen, Germany. And this was done on an old industrial site that was just kind of a wasteland. There's a hodgepodge of tons of older buildings there. And they were reusing some of those buildings, but the buildings were not going to really, they were just meant to be industrial buildings, and they weren't very exciting or iconic. And so when they built the design school as part of this campus, it was great to reuse those buildings, but they needed some of the buildings to draw your eye, to be a little more iconic. So they decided to make the design school one of these, and they hired Kazuo Sejima. Her firm is called Sanaa. Really fantastic. She's currently practicing also. Incredible architect. Has won the Pritzker Prize, which is the ultimate, like the Nobel Prize for architecture. And in 2006, she did this building, which is just a cube in the center of this campus with a hodgepodge of other buildings. This is particularly iconic. It draws your eye. You notice it. It focuses the attention. And then within it, every window was meant also to focus your attention. And sometimes you're in a single room, like a conference room, and there's a window, and it stands for that conference room. Or it may be an office, and it's a square window, and it stands for that office. And the windows are not about some larger order. They're about making an object, making that room, making that office, making that classroom, making that entrance, whatever it is, an iconic thing, a special thing. And each window finds its own place or position and becomes just this object. So the building is an object, and then each window within it becomes an object and focuses your attention. And just then, by where those rooms are and what kind or size of window it needs, each of them becomes this iconic square window through the whole building. And sometimes, as in this lounge, there are several of them, so that each one becomes a kind of object that focuses you, and it disassociates itself from its neighbor by not aligning and not being part of a larger community of windows, but each thing being iconic. And the square is a wonderful device for doing that. And then throughout the building, as you can see in the detail on the left, It's extremely precise. Perfectly square corners. All the little joints are all aligned perfectly, so the thing is made with extraordinary precision. So that's a final way of using geometry. So we use it for mysticism. We use it for prestige. We use it because it makes structural sense. We use it as a kind of intellectual puzzle. And we use it as a way of focusing our eye or making something that's iconic. And then sometimes you can see buildings that actually combine all of these. And a good example of that might be the Capitol buildings in Dhaka, Bangladesh, by Louis Kahn, done over a very long period of time. This was an extremely complicated building story. Originally, Louis Kahn was hired to do the capital of East Pakistan. And Edward Durrell Stone was hired to do the capital of West Pakistan. When there was the subdivision of India and Pakistan and they were separated from the British Empire in the 1950s, because Pakistan was not all contiguous, it had an eastern portion of it and a western portion, the idea was that they would have two capitals and that half the year the government would be in one capital and half the year the government would be in the other capital. And this was to be the capital of East Pakistan. And so because you had to move the government, there was meant to be housing that was associated with the Capitol building for those ministers. So that's the actual Capitol building. And then housing for the ministers that would go along here. And you can see the housing right here and the Capitol building there. And it becomes a whole complex of the Capitol, the housing for the ministers, the secretariat where the bureaucracy would be, this grand scheme for a new capital of East Pakistan. In the middle of building this, East Pakistan broke off from West Pakistan and established the country of Bangladesh. And it could easily have been that they would say, oh man, that was the old regime, we're abandoning that, that's those guys we threw out. But instead, the Bangladeshis actually embraced this half-built building, and it became a great symbol for their independence. And so it is today a very, very beautiful capital and a very beloved capital of that country of Bangladesh. So a lot of the things we've been talking about, the necessity for prestige, the necessity for an iconic building, certainly a necessity for something that made structural sense, all of these things were applicable and I think became a part of making this very powerful geometric object. The Capitol building is built all of concrete. The housing is built of brick. It is really the Capitol building that is this powerful assembly of geometric pieces. It is a dodecagon in the center, a 12-sided polygon. The pieces on the side, there's squares as you can see, and then squares cut out of the squares. There are half circles, there are full circles. The whole thing is an assembly of geometric pieces. And that's true in plan, and it's also true in the facade. Great circular windows, multi-story kind of circular openings, triangular openings, the rectangles on the lower part below that triangle, those are golden proportion, roughly 5 by 8 in dimension, circular openings. Inside the building, the same kind of powerful geometry modulating everything in the building. And again, getting the prestige and getting the iconic quality that was necessary in that building. And at the same time, making sensible forms in construction. The brick wants to make an arch. That worked very well with the circles. The concrete works very well with the structural shape of the pyramid. This is in the mosque. And you actually have circle in the vertical dimension, circle in the horizontal dimension, all of that as a light baffle that lets light in each of the four corners of the mosque. And in fact, that mosque is really quite an exciting and interesting thing. The whole plan of the building is on a north, south, east, west axis, but you can see at the bottom down here, that's the mosque with the four circles. And it's just a little kinked off from the rest of it. And that's because the mosque is facing Mecca, which is not exactly east, but close to east of the site. So the geometry is God. It's putting this whole building together. Okay, Twitter card question for today. At this point, you ought to be able to anticipate. But so think of a building. I don't care. Your hometown, somewhere here on campus, somewhere you visited on a trip. What is a building that is very strongly based on geometry, on numbers, on mathematics, on geometry? And how does that reinforce the role of that building? Maybe in one of the five ways that we described, does it add prestige to the building? Does it make it more iconic? Does it actually make it make structural sense? Is it a kind of mystical thing? Does it create a kind of intellectual puzzle? What is it in the geometry of that building that makes it a powerful architectural device?